factors on quantum theory before, here, although I think that really means quantum mechanics and a little bit of its applications. One of the difficulties that I've had is trying to understand what it is that you know, what it is that you don't know, and therefore what should be in these lectures and what should not. That was the point of having a test last week to find out what it is you didn't know. And one thing which I'm told was apparent from what you did was that angular momentum needs to be revised a bit. Perhaps if that's true, you think that's true and you agree with it, you could put your hand up at this point. One, three, four. So this would seem to be then a minority interest. So what I was going to do for the first lecture in a bit was to review the issues of angular momentum. And I think that my starting point might be a little bit different to other people's starting points. But I want to bring out the relationship between ordinary group theory and what you find in the quantum mechanics of angular momentum. So maybe things will be a little bit different to what you've seen before. So the starting point is to start off in three-dimensional Euclidean space. I think that I'll generalize this to four-dimensional space-time at some point, which is why I'm going to make a fuss about this kind of thing. And just simply start talking about rotations. So the idea of a rotation is that you start off with a set of coordinates, or so this will be the label of some point. Labeling a point in R3. And what I want to do is to perform a rotation on it to find the position of a new set of coordinates. So I want to perform a rotation. To get new coordinates of the point. And I'm going to call these x prime, y prime, z prime. The way in which you do this is to simply say, well, there is some kind of matrix R which maps the old coordinates into the new coordinates. So these xj represents the components of x in the old coordinate system. And this is a new coordinate system. So what do we know about R? Well, one thing you know about R is it has got to preserve lengths. So that means that x prime I squared, that's the distance of the point x prime from the origin squared. I will use the Einstein summation convention whenever it is necessary to do that. So this object is going to be R I J X J, R I K X K. And this thing has got to be the same thing as xj, xj. So you see, the consequence of that is that R must obey the following equation, R, I, J, R, I, K, has got to be delta JK. If I want to write that in matrix notation, it just simply says that R transpose R is equal to the identity. So in other words, R must be an orthogonal matrix. You can take, perhaps the best way to, the thing to do is just to say that that's really what you mean by this particular group. Or at least define some aspect of this particular group. It's usually called SO3. Special orthogonal transformations in dimension 3. R, as we have thought about it here, is a particular representation of that group in terms of 3x3 matrices.
How do you build that space invergence?
Sorry?
How do you build that space invergence?
I haven't yet.
So
yeah, I'm going to deal with space inversions in a second, or at least I'm going to say something about them. Since the question of space inversions came up, we have to decide whether or not we want to include them. I do not want to include them. The relationship R transpose R equals the identity you can use to discover that take the determinant of both sides and you'll get determinant of R squared is equal to 1. And therefore, the determinant of R is plus or minus 1. The point about spatial rotations is that if you, the fact that we're dealing with SO3 requires the determinant to be plus 1, and therefore does not include spatial rotations, reflections. I mean reflections, not rotations. If you have det R is equal to minus 1, then of course you do have reflections. And an example of that would be taking R to be 1, 1, minus 1, which you can see is a reflection in the z equals 0 plane. So I'm not going to consider things with det minus 1. Everything that I've done here satisfies the axioms for a group. So let's just remind ourselves what the axioms for a group actually are. I hope everyone can see this board. It's a bit. So the first is it must contain the identity element. Well, if you ask yourself, does it? The answer is simple. Yes, it does. I transpose times I is equal to I. Det of I is equal to 1. So that's no problem. Second, each element of the group must contain a unique inverse. Well, we've already constructed that from the definition of what this thing is. R transpose is equal to R inverse. So there's a mechanical way of finding the inverse of something. So that axiom for a group is satisfied. Composition law. Perform a group operation then perform a second group operation, and that must also be in the group. So let's consider R to be the product of two transformations, R2 and R1. Then R transpose is equal to R1 transpose R2 transpose. And so R transpose R is equal to R1 transpose R2 transpose R2 R1. This thing collapses down to the identity. And then this thing is the identity again. So that's satisfied. Lastly, there's the associativity property, which means that if you take three of these things, it doesn't matter in which order you do it. So you take R1, R2, and R3, and you can reach R1, R2, R3 two different ways. You can combine R2 and R3 first, then multiply by R1, or you can do it the other way around. You can have R3 and then do R1 combined with R2, but those two are obviously the same because matrix multiplication is associative. So this thing does form a group. Now let's think about what kind of object is R actually going to be. The easiest place to start is probably by just thinking about rotations in the XY plane. Rotations you really want to think of as being in a plane. In three dimensions, there is a nice coincidence, and that is that, of course, a plane has a vector perpendicular to it, and you generally tend to think of rotations as being where you move around some particular vector. So if you were just thinking about rotations in the XY plane, that would be the vector in the Z direction. But that is an artifact of being in dimension three. Of course, you can say that we do live in three spatial dimensions, so it's not so bad. But when we come to do something relativistic, it will be a bit different. So it really is planes that are involved. And you always sort of think about this example when you want to generalize to find arbitrary rotations. So suppose that I have coordinates x and y of some point, and I perform a rotation to find some new coordinates, x prime and y prime, then you can, and of course, because we're just in the xy plane, then z will be fixed. So first of all, the thing to do is contemplate how to do that. Well, what you can do to make it easy is to draw yourself a complicated picture. So I have tried to perfect drawing a complicated picture, but I'm not sure I've succeeded. I actually looked in Shankar's book, and I must say that although that's recommended as being something where you can find most things, the derivation that you find there is incredibly ungeometrical. What you really want to do is a little bit of simple geometry to find out what the new things are. So let's suppose these are a set of axes with the y direction being there and the x direction being there, and I perform a rotation of theta in the clockwise direction to find the new ones. So this would be y prime, this would be x prime, and that angle would be theta. And then what I want to do is to take some particular point, let's say somewhere up here, that in the ordinary, in the original coordinate system, has got coordinates x and y. And what we want to do is to find the new x prime and y prime. So this really is just geometry. So the simple thing to do is just to draw yourself a picture that shows you, first of all, where y and x actually are. So here is y, here is x, here is y, here is x. Y, x. You want to find the value of x prime and the value of y prime. So maybe the thing to do is to use a different color to make that work. So here is the distance y prime is that one, and the distance x prime is going to be that distance there. So we want to find out what those things actually are. And this is simply a question of geometry. If you look in Shankar, you'll discover all kinds of strange things involving differential equations. It's not necessary to do that. So you know that that's a right angle, and you know that that's a right angle. So if this angle is theta, that angle is 90 minus theta. That one is 90 minus theta. That one is theta. And that really is more or less all you need to do to be able to figure out what's going on. The easiest thing to do now is just to put in a few more lines. So I want to have that one and that one. So what can we see from this picture? If you're interested in various distances here, then you immediately see that this line here has got lengths, let's say, between here and there, is going to be y times cos theta. This one here, that length of that leg of the triangle, is going to be y sine theta. Then we want to look at this distance. Let's see. X prime is that length there. So what you need to do is to ask yourself, well, what we are after trying to find, we know everything in this picture. We know this length from there to there. That's x. So here you know that that length here is going to be x sine theta. And this length here is going to be x cos theta. That's from that distance. Straight, it's that one, that point. So now that we have absolutely everything that we need, x prime and y prime, we can now write in terms of the other things. So x prime is going to be x cos theta minus this distance here. So it's going to be x cos theta minus y sine theta. And then y prime is going to be, so that's this distance here, is going to be that one plus that one. So it's going to be y cos theta plus x sine theta. So if you want to rewrite that as a matrix, then x prime, y prime, and I guess there's a z prime as well, which we kept fixed, in terms of the old things as cos theta minus sine theta, 0, sine theta, cos theta, 0, 1, 0, 0. As you can see, just staring at that matrix here, this is obviously an orthogonal matrix, because if you transpose it, it's the same as taking the inverse. And it has unit determinant. So calculating these things for some simple case is really not so hard. I'm afraid I don't know how to make this picture less confused. The only thing to do is to just draw it patiently yourself and decide that you really do believe it. You probably could, but I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do it this way. Now we got to this stage, we could ask ourselves, what would you get if you wanted to do a rotation about an arbitrary vector, say a unit vector n? Well, so let's do a rotation of theta about an arbitrary unit vector ni. Well, what you do is you just basically stare at this thing and realize that the arbitrary unit vector that you've got in this picture is the unit vector in the z direction. So this is an example in which ni is equal to 0, 0, 1. So how would you manage to construct an rij that reproduces this and does the thing that you need? Well, the one thing that you do know is that the length in the direction of n is preserved. So that's a clue as to how to do this. So what you've got here is a 1 in that direction and a cos theta along the diagonals. So the simple thing to do is just to say, well, let's try to reproduce that to start with. You've got a delta ij, and if you're not in the direction of n, then of course it just is cos theta. So you can multiply that by cos theta. And then to get the direction in the z direction, get that component, you want to get a 1. So you have a 1 minus cos theta ni nj. And that will give you the diagonal components exactly right. Then you have to worry about these off-diagonal components. Those are, of course, perpendicular to n. And so you have a contribution of the form epsilon ijk nk and a sine theta. And that comes with a minus sign, at least with my conventions. Epsilon, let me remind you, is the alternating tensor in dimension 3. Or you can just think about it as being the alternating symbol, if you like. I guess you all know about that, hopefully.
It's a beta.
And that will give us what you need. And you can see this is the right kind of thing. If you contract this with ni, then of course we're going to get just a 1 for some that term combining figure of 1. So of course gives you nothing. So that does give you what you want. So this represents a rotation through theta clockwise about the n direction. I'm going to put an axis defined by ni. Remember that ni is a unit vector. So that's how you represent a specific rotation. And of course, we'll come back to that when we think about angular momentum. So that's what you get from the root. There's another way of thinking about groups. This group that we have been talking about is a Lie group, and a Lie group is basically characterized by having a continuous set of parameters representing the rotations about some particular axis. So this is an example of a Lie group. And as a consequence of that, you can write any element of the group in the following way. As the exponential of, I'm going to put a factor of minus I here for convenience, lambda I, and then pi. Pi are the parameters of the group. And the lambda I are referred to as the generators of the group. So in this particular case, this thing is supposed to be a 3x3 matrix. So the lambda i's are also going to be 3x3 matrices. And I have not actually written out their matrix indices. There's just going to be three of them. Reflecting the fact that there are three independent rotations that you can perform, either about the x or the y or the z axis. Another way of doing this would be to use Euler angles, but that's more complicated, and I really don't want to do that. Well, if you were too shy to tell me. Yeah?
Sorry, you said any element could be represented this way?
Yes.
So how do we, I mean, intuitively, right, we know we can't because you just, like, rotate along the sphere. But, like what if, you know, what if it were disconnected?
It's not disconnected in this case because it's the special formula group we restricted ourselves to determinant one. If you wanted me to include reflections, I have to include the reflections as discrete things.
Oh, okay. So you can exponentiate anything from either, okay.
Right, all of these things you see are continuously connected to the identity by putting pi equals zero. But if you want to include the reflection, you just say, well, there's a reflection operator rho, which could be a reflection, say, in the xy plane. That thing. And then you have things that look like that, which give you one set of things. And then rho times the same thing would give you the other thing in the other orbit.
So if you're not disconnected, do you always have something like this where you can, like...
Yes.
Cool, okay.
Yeah.
So then the orthogonal group of dimension 2 is basically like a continuous analog of dihedral groups?
I said in dimension 2, I said it was a continuous analog of the ZK, the cyclic group. You worry about reflection?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, you could think of Z infinity as being the same thing as SO2, so I guess you can put the dihedral group in to get the reflection.
Yeah.
Sounds right. So let's actually compute the generators for this particular case. I forgot one thing. One thing I ought to do. If we're going to parameterize things this way, then of course R transpose is equal to R inverse. So that turns out to be constraint on the nature of the lambdas. I was supposed to tell you what the exponential of a matrix was. If M was just an ordinary real variable, so that it would be, then you would say this was 1 plus x squared over 2 factorial plus x cubed over 3 factorial from Taylor's theorem. You just define the exponential of a matrix in exactly the same way. So this would be 1 plus the matrix plus 1 over 2 factorial times the matrix squared plus 1 over 3 factorial times the matrix cubed, etc. And you just keep going forever. So that's what you mean by the exponential of a matrix. Now let's look at R transpose, R inverse. R transpose is going to be the exponential of minus I lambda I transpose PI, whereas R inverse is going to be the exponential of I times lambda I PI. And this has got to be true for all PI. So that tells you that lambda I is equal to minus lambda I transpose. So you know that that's a condition on the generators that we have. Now let's see if we can identify what these generators actually are. The way to do this, in fact, this is works really for all Lie groups and is sort of central to the idea of transformations in quantum mechanics. At some level, it's why Wigner is famous. So the idea is to just simply consider infinitesimal transformations. This complicated-looking thing here is, of course, a finite transformation, but an infinitesimal transformation is easy to write down. So make theta small. I suppose we could call it delta theta if you wanted to emphasize the fact that it's small, and do the calculation to first order in theta. This is a 1, that's a 1, so you get nothing from here. You just get delta ij from here. From here, you get epsilon ijk nk delta theta. Let's compare that with what we got from the exponential parameterization of a group element, assuming that p is small. From this formula over here, we get that R as a matrix is equal to 1 minus I lambda I PI. Now, of course, we can all see that I've done one really bad thing here, as I called this thing I. Since I'm summing over the I's, I think I would like to call that something else. Let's call it P, make it different. Now, this really is a matrix. Here I've written it out explicitly with matrix labels, I and J, and I can do the same thing here. So if I have an I and J, let's call that I and J. 1 is just a Kronecker delta, so it's delta ij. This is a 3x3 matrix, and so it will also have labels ij. We have to decide what P is, the parameter labeling the group. Well, we're just going to say that that's the same thing as NP times delta theta. So if we've done this right, we have a formula for the generators of the group in terms of something rather concrete, the epsilons. And let's say we make this clear. We are talking here about the representation in terms of 3x3 matrices. We'll just read it off from here. You get minus I times lambda p ij is the same thing as minus epsilon ijp. So let's emphasize this once again. The p-th generator has components ij, it's a 3x3 matrix, and they turn out to be these things. We can multiply by I to make life a little bit easier. Lambda p times ij is equal to I minus I times epsilon ijp. So that's an explicit formula for the generators of SO3 in that particular representation. Now, one thing that will help you make contact with the theory of angular momentum is to remember that the angular momentum operator obeys a particular set of common commutation rules which characterize angular momentum. The same is kind of true for all Lie groups. All Lie groups are categorized by how their generators commute with each other. It's almost, but not completely true, that knowing the commutation rules tells you what the group is. We'll come across an example in which it's not completely true shortly, because angular momentum is an example of it. We say that mostly characterized by their commutation rules. So let's calculate what those are in this particular case. Yeah?
You said that, all the rotation groups are like subsets of these groups.
All the elements of rotations are elements of this group, yes. All possible, any rotation you care to think about is an element of group SO3. Okay.
The notation of group
theory is, I guess, very new to me.
I was just trying to get a feel for what
Lie
groups actually are and how they're different from
rotation. Oh, what I will do is I will find a couple of problems to illustrate that particular point. But I really wanted to do the quantum mechanical version first, because what you know about angular momentum and time translation and things like that are really just examples of Lie groups. So I think that should become apparent as we go on. So let's try to calculate the commutator of two things. So let's take the generator lambda p and commute it with lambda q. Each of these are 3x3 matrices. So this thing will have some matrix labels. Let's call them I and k. So this is going to be lambda p, lambda q, being the p-th lambda and the q-th lambda. We look for matrix multiplication on it. So the first index is definitely an I, and the second index is a k. But you have to sum over the intermediate index, so an intermediate index j, which is there. And the only difference between having things, the other term in the commutator is just the same thing with p and q swap rack. So it's minus lambda q, ij, lambda p, jk. So this is the commutator written as a 3x3 matrix with explicit matrices indices written in ij, jk here, ij, jk, where this refers to the p-th generator. Now we have this nice formula here. Lambda Pij is minus I times epsilon ijp. This thing is going to give me minus and a minus and an I squared gives me an overall minus. We've got two of them. Then you have an epsilon Pij, epsilon qjk. That's that term. This term here is plus epsilon q. I've got my indices in the wrong order. Let's try that again. The thing that labels which lambda it is the one that goes to the end. So let's try again. I, J, P, and then J, K, Q. From here we have I, J, Q. And here we have J, K, P. Now, presumably, everyone remembers the formula for multiplying two epsilons for subtracting on one index.
Oh, wait,
if you don't, I was going to do it for you. This thing is delta B D delta C E minus delta B D delta D. So apply that to this formula. So here you're contracting on the second index and the first, so if you move these two round, you get an overall minus sign, and then it's an example of that kind of thing. So you'll get delta IK, delta DQ, minus delta IQ, delta DK. And from this one you'll get the same kind of thing. Move those two round, you get a minus sign, then it's of that form. So you get IK, PQ plus delta I P delta KQ. Now if I've done this right, two things will cancel, those two. And then you should recognize this as also being the combination of two epsilons. It is equal to epsilon. So I can cheat here. P, Q. Now, how do I do it? N, lambda N, IK. Did I get my sign right? But I was not right about that. Where's the roses? Now, do I get the sign block? That should be IP. Yes, that's one sign. This I want to leave alone. This I want to rewrite in terms of the generators of the group. So this is epsilon PQM, lambda M, and then it's going to be an IK and a factor of I, and that's it. So if we left out the matrix indices, you see that you end up with something which is familiar. So you would get lambda p commuted with lambda q is equal to I times epsilon pqm lambda m. And hopefully you will all recognize that as being the commutation rules for the angular momentum operator, apart from a factor of h bar.
So what we have done here is to find the generators of SO3 in a particular representation, the representation of 3x3 matrices, which is usually called the vector representation. And in so doing, we have discovered that it reproduces the commutation rules for just the angular momentum operator. Now let's go and think about quantum mechanics with this in mind. What is the angular momentum operator? Classically, angular momentum about some point. Remember, you have to take angular momentum about some point. It's different about different points. Is given by L is R cross P, this being the vector product. That's one way that you can write it. If you want to turn this into a quantum mechanical operator, you would probably say, well, P is the same thing as minus I H bar del. And you would substitute that into L, and you'd say, ah, that means that L is equal to minus I H bar R cross the gradient operator. And that would be fine. In fact, it's what everybody always does. There is, of course, some unfortunate ambiguity here. I wrote it R cross P. You might say, how do you know you're not supposed to write it as minus P cross R and have the del in a different place? Well, that is a very mild example of a more general problem that I don't particularly want to discuss now. So that's one way of writing the angular momentum operator. We can relate this to things that we know. Probably the best thing to do is to rewrite this in the following way. It's useful to have the angular momentum operator in terms of its Cartesian components. We can either do it all at once, so the ith component of L is equal to minus I h bar, psilon I j k, x j, partial derivative with respect to x k, which I write that way. So this thing to me means d by dx k. I hope that's not so bad. That's one way in which you can write it. Again, I'm using the summation convention. X j just simply means the components of R, so it's just x, y, z. Or, if you want to do it explicitly, in terms of differential operators, component by component, you can write it as minus I h bar y d by dz minus z d by dy minus I h bar z d by dx minus x d by dz minus I h bar x d by dy minus y d by dx. You can do a slightly unpleasant calculation along the same lines that we did before and discover that if you commute these operators, you find the commutation rules of these operators. It's not too hard I guess you must have all, everyone has done this calculation at some point in the past, so I won't do it, I'll just tell you what the answer is. So if you work out the commutation of Li with Lj, you will get I times epsilon ijk Lk, a factor of h bar, and that's it. I guess we've all seen that before. Has anyone not seen it before? Good. So this is identical to the commutation rule for the generators of SO3. Except for a factor of h bar. The factor of h bar has just sort of unfortunately appeared here. We don't really want it, but it doesn't really do anything terribly useful for you, mathematically at any rate. Because you can always just rescale your operators to get rid of the h-bar. So if you said everywhere you wrote L, you wrote h-bar L, then you'd get rid of it. That's a consequence of the fact that the L's are dimension full, whereas when I wrote down the generators for SO3, they were dimensionless. So this is just a problem of dimensions. So a mathematician would just say, well, just choose h bar to be equal to 1 and forget about it. I don't think that really works if you're a physicist, because if you take the limit as h bar goes to 0, these things really do commute. So classically, these things commute, whereas quantum mechanically, they don't. But really, the non-commutativity that you find here is a consequence of the fact that you're dealing with rotations. You don't really want to think so much of it as being quantum mechanical. But when you stare at this thing, the sort of practical realization of these operators L, well, these things have nothing to do with the 3x3 matrices that we found before. So this is a different representation, and it's a representation of SO3 on the space of all functions. Well, I said all functions rather loosely. We have to be a bit careful. These things involve the derivative operator, so they better be differentiable functions. And quantum mechanically, of course, these functions are the wave functions. So they'd better be normalizable. By normalizable, I mean that they're square integrable, namely the integral of psi star psi d3x has got to be less than infinity. By differentiable, all I mean here is that they must be at least first differentiable once everywhere. Square integrable is sometimes written as, by the mathematicians, the saying that these functions have got to lie in the space L2 of R3. L2 just means square integrable. R3 means when you integrate over all of three-dimensional space. So that means square integrable. Over all of space. We might meet some other examples that are slightly different. So, for example, L1 just means integrable. But We'll come across some examples. Don't worry too much about that. So that's one presentation of the angular momentum operators. How much time do I have left? 5 minutes. Oh dear. Oh dear, is what I said. How many?
20.
That's much better. That will allow me to do what I want to do, I think. This business here might seem like a picky mathematical point, but we will come across an example in 19 minutes. I hope. Another way of thinking about the angular momentum operators is in spherical coordinates. And of course, spherical coordinates are well adapted to trying to understand what's going on with angular momentum. So you can do some explicit calculations. X, you can rewrite Y and Z in terms of spherical polar coordinates. So you'll get something that looks like this. And then you can rewrite LX, LY, and LZ in terms of what happens on the unit sphere. So if I do this, LX will turn into IH bar sine theta d by d phi plus cos phi cot theta. Wait a minute, something looks wrong here. Yes. That should be a phi. It should be a theta. It looks better. Cot theta d by d phi. Ly is equal to IH bar into minus cos phi d by d theta plus sine phi cot theta d by d phi. And LZ is equal to minus IH bar d by d phi. So those are the angular momentum operators in polar coordinates. And those are really the most useful way of trying to understand what the possible wave functions are going to be. I presume that you have seen this before somewhere, or at least. So you can derive those formulae just by doing the change of variables indicated up there carefully. Another operator that you can find is the total angular momentum operator, L squared. This is LX squared plus LY squared plus LZ squared. As far as SO3 is concerned, this is a central term. And the consequence of that is referred to as a Casimir operator. L squared commutes with all of the L's. That's what I mean by a central object. And it's often referred to as a Casimir operator because of that particular fact. So one thing, consequence of that, is that you can regard L squared and one component of the L's, typically LZ, as being something which describes all possible wave functions. So their eigenvalues describe all possible wave functions. One thing I should have said and forgot, if you look at this, LX, LY, and LZ are all independent of R. Although you've used R here, these operators do not depend on R. If you want an explicit representation of L squared, where you can work out the square of that plus the square of that plus the square of that, which I don't recommend doing. I'll tell you what it is. It's minus h bar squared into d2 by d theta squared plus cot theta d by d theta plus 1 over sine squared theta d2 by d phi squared. Yes?
LX, LY, and LZ acting on L2, R3?
Yes.
Okay. Did we actually find the representation of the rotation group on L2, R3?
Only by inferring it from this.
Oh, okay. So we just sort of guessed those?
Yeah. Well, no. We worked out that they were things like minus y h bar, x d by dy, minus y d by dx.
Okay.
And then translated, and those
are really right. So you worked out
the
right.
And then we translated these into these this coordinate system. Because it's easier.
Okay.
So this now tells you everything you need to know about the wave function. The wave functions that describe states of specified angular momentum. Eigenfunctions of L squared and LZ. And if you need an explicit representation of what that is, L squared acting on some psi is going to be something. LZ acting on some psi is going to be something times psi. And my guess is that you have done this in the past. You would have discovered that this is equal to m h bar times psi, and this is equal to L into L plus 1 times h bar squared times psi. L are all positive integers and 0, up forever. M is minus L in integer steps up to plus L. And there will, of course, be 2L plus 1 of these. So these things correspond to the azimuthal quantum number. This is the total angular momentum quantum number. If you want an explicit form of the wave functions, then the easiest thing to do is to stare at this equation here. Well, LZ acting on psi equals MH bar times psi is going to be the same thing as IH bar d by d phi of psi equals m h bar times psi. So that's the LZ equation. The L squared equation is this thing minus h bar squared d2 by d theta squared plus cot theta d by d theta plus 1 over sine squared theta d2 by d phi squared is equal to L into L plus 1 h bar squared times psi. And it's fairly easy to find the phi dependence. This thing, you can just integrate up, and it tells you if you solve this equation, you will get psi equals any function of theta you like times e to the I m phi. You can see from this immediately that m had better be an integer, otherwise this thing is not going to be single valued.
if you send phi to phi plus 2 pi, in terms of the x, y, and z coordinates, you get back to where you started from. It just simply corresponds to a rotation around the axis once. It's the same point. But your wave function had better not change, because if it did, it wouldn't have a single value. And so m had better be an integer. That may seem like an obvious point, but you will discover that in many quantum mechanical phenomena, also in quantum field theory, string theory, everywhere really, you discover that exactly the same phenomenon happens over and over again and leads to all kinds of interesting things. We'll do a couple of examples later on. What is P? Well, if you think back to whatever course you did in quantum mechanics, you probably remember these as being the associated Legendre functions. They are rather unpleasant. You get them by solving, sticking this form into this and solving the appropriate differential equation. And you will just simply get a mess. I'm not going to write out what the associated Legendre functions are explicitly, but I'll do it in terms of spherical harmonics instead. So these two things together, for fixed L and M, are usually called the spherical harmonics. YLM of theta and phi. They are conventionally normalized such that the integral of YLM of theta and phi star Y L prime M prime of theta and phi integrated over the sphere, remember there's no radial coordinate in this, sine theta d phi, is equal to delta L L prime delta M M prime, showing the explicit orthogonality of these things. So that you should sort of know. There is a useless formula. In fact, this is the most useless formula that I think I'm ever going to write down, which tells you what the YLMs are, should you ever have the misfortune to need to know it. It's equal to minus to the L over 2 to the L L factorial, square root of 2L factorial over 4 pi, times L plus M factorial divided by 2L factorial L minus M factorial, end of square root, sine theta to the minus M d by d cos theta acting L minus M times on sine theta to the 2L. Let's put a little bracket around this thing. Times e to the im phi. It's only worth knowing that such a formula exists. I do not expect anyone to remember it. I certainly can't. But the point is, it does exist. And I suppose you might someday just about need it. You can look that up in tables of things, or I suppose you could probably get some computer to work it out for you. It is, however, useful to be familiar with a small number of low-lying possibilities. I want to keep that, so let's put this over here. So examples for small L and M. The first is Y00. Well, if you just stare at these two equations, that's got no theta or phi dependence. It's just a normalization, 1 over the square root of 4 pi, which you could have guessed by staring at the normalization thing, knowing that it didn't have any dependence on anything else. The next one is y1, 0. That's supposed to look like it's got no dependence in the phi direction, so this must just look like p1 of cos theta up to a normalization. So you just get p1 of cos theta, which is cos theta. The normalization you could work out from that condition rather than remember it, and you will get 3 over 4 pi to the half. So that should come as no surprise. Y of 1 plus or minus 1. Well, p1, 1, if you remember, is sine theta. It's not too hard. Plus or minus 1 gives you plus or minus e to the I phi. And the normalization factor is 3 over 8 pi to the 1 half. And if you work out from this horrible formula at the top, you'll get a minus or plus. The key things to note here is it's cos theta, which looks like p1, and sine theta e to the plus or minus I phi. The normalizations you can just figure out for yourself at some later point. The key things are these two things. And I suppose we can put in y2, 21 and y2 plus or minus 2 for completeness. And you will get, get this right. Well, p2 we all know to be 3 cos squared theta minus 1, an overall factor of 2. And you'll discover the normalization is 5 over 16 pi to the half. So this sort of looks like p2 of cos theta. y2 plus or minus 1 is sine theta cos theta e to the plus or minus I phi. And then there's a minus or plus, 15 over 8 pi to the half. And y2 plus or minus 2 is sine squared theta e to the plus or minus 2 I phi, 15 over 32 pi, again to the 1 half. And at this point, I ran out of energy in trying to write these things down. I hope all of these are familiar. In practice, you don't use these things. If you want to work something out, what you would say is that YLM of theta and phi is really the projection of the state LM into the coordinate representation. So it's that object. And if you wanted to do a realistic calculation, you would use abstract properties of operators acting on the states LM, rather than work things out using integrals and horrible special function technology. Or at least I think I would. So, let's do point to an interesting problem. Everybody, of course, knows that the possible angular momenta are not given by integers. You say, I've got 2 minutes. Right. It might take 3, but never mind. So the L's and M's here were all integers. But we know that there is such a thing as half-integral angular momenta. So what goes wrong if you try to describe half-integral angular momenta using this formalism? Well, if I'll just call that little l. If little l is a half, we probably expect m to be a half. So step one is we try to find those eigenfunctions. So right at the outset, we get an e to the I phi of 2. So we're already in trouble from not being single valued. If you work out from here what the function of theta is that you've got to have, you'll end up with sine theta to the half. So that is your putative wave function that corresponds to, apart from the normalization, to L equals a half, M equals a half. Well, that's terrible. First of all, it's not single-valued. And secondly, this thing is not differentiable at the poles, theta equals 0 and pi. And therefore violates two of the things that I said were essential. So this violates essential properties of wave functions. So for that reason, you have to invent a much better explanation as to what spin half, angular momentum half is about. Which I guess we'll move on to later. Yes?
Sort of a more abstract way of saying this, like what abstractly goes wrong when you try to represent, I mean, spin one half particles again, they're just like all the other particles are representations of SO3, so.
Well, they're not. That's what we just discovered.
Oh.
Can't be done, because it's not single value, it's not differentiable. The angular part of a spin half wave function in space has these two pathologies.
But I mean, you do, like you can represent, so 3 on SU2, or
rather on SU2. SU2 is quite different.
What?
SU2 is different than SO3.
Right.
Yes, if you wanted to represent them in space, you have to adopt the double covering of SO3,
okay,
which is a somewhat different thing. I wanted to do this to show you that something went badly wrong if you try to interpret spin half as a wave function in R3.
Okay.
That's really what's wrong. So in terms of describing it in terms of space just doesn't work. Because of these two problems.
So what was the argument that the wave function had to be single value?
Well, it's a function. Which value would I pick? So suppose, for example, I wanted to work out, I wanted to do something with the wave function. Say, for example, integrate it over space.
So why would you do that? Integrate the wave function. Is this like for solving some differential equation or something like that? I mean, I'm just raising the point about the, to what extent does it have to be single value?
Well, you have to get amplitudes out. And yeah, to do the inner product, you have to integrate it.
So what value of the function am I going to choose at some point?
What do you do for normalizing?
For example.
So, but what about minus signs?
Well, you could just, in this particular case, I think it's not too bad. If you could convince yourself that being double valued was okay, then it would be fine. But I can't convince myself that the function has got two values. We have descriptions
for which one to take. Oh, it's double valued everywhere?
Yes, double valued
everywhere. Oh, so this is just telling you that you have to use a direct line.
Yeah.
Yes, okay.
Oh, I didn't.
Oh.
Well, if we actually do spin half, we will think a bit harder about it. I just don't know what is meant by a function which is double valued. It's like saying that what is the square root of x? Well, the answer is plus or minus the square root of x. And you always need a description as to which one it's going to be. So if you were trying to do functions of a complex variable, one way of doing it would be to introduce a cut. And say, well, you just can't go one thing to the other, there's a discontinuity in the function. Or alternatively, you say there are two Riemann sheets. So if you go round once in the complex plane and come to where it looks like there's a discontinuity, you actually go onto a different sheet. So you could do something like that. And that really is what you do when you go from SO3 to SU2.
That sounds
yeah.
like sort of a bad example, because it doesn't. So a negative number, right, will. Yeah, like, generally, don't you always have, like, two roots?
You always have two roots, yeah.
So, if you go anywhere, so it seems like, it's not like it's unnatural, it's not like you're splitting somewhere, it's just that you have a function you know, from one complex number and maps to two complex numbers, and there's. I mean, I guess you have to decide
like,
which way
to put it. It's just like a branch cut. You have to decide what to do. You need a method for deciding what to do. And anything you decide would appear to be rather arbitrary.
Okay, well, can we have a break? 20 minutes, yeah, before.
Gianni's here. Rather cheeky.
Thanks, right? It's like 40 minutes.